8%
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The committee will come to order. We do have a quorum present. Representative Albright moves the minutes from February 8, 2017. I have a correction to make. Scratch Hamilton from excused and add to present. That change being made, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Today we have the governor's budget proposal by DHS, and we will be going through that today. We will begin with Assistant Commissioner Nathan Morocco with some health care issues. Welcome to the committee. Commissioner, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Health Care Administration at the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, do you have a preference? I'll be covering several items here, whether you'd want me to go through the whole presentation, take questions as we go.
I think we'll take questions as we go. We should have plenty of time to get through the presentation with questions. So if members do have questions, to refer back to the packet and whatever presentation we have. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, as I indicated, as Assistant Commissioner of the Healthcare Administration, we have several proposals in the area of healthcare, health reform, identifying better ways to make healthcare more efficient for the clients that we serve on public programs. Just as a point of reference, today we're covering about 96% of Minnesotans having health care. Certainly there's a large portion of that that's covered under Medicaid and Minnesota Care, which are the two programs run out of my administration. But certainly we want to strive to find ways to find more value both for the state in terms of the cost of the program and improving the outcomes on behalf of the clients that we serve. So largely our proposals are focused on how can we provide better value for the state and for the client, improving access for the clients that we serve, and generating better health outcomes. The highlights then include modernizing the purchasing that we do in the healthcare administration. Some of that includes improving the provider rates in an attempt to improve access for the clients, promoting continuity of coverage, and improving the dental access. In total, all funds investments is $32 million. Some of the proposals save money, some of the proposals reinvest those savings back into the programs, and some of the proposals add additional dollars, and we'll certainly get into those specifics here next. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, just for your assistance, the next set of proposals are on page 74 through 79. You'll note in the upper right-hand corner of the PowerPoint the page numbers that are specifically being referenced. There's actually a lot of sort of sub-proposals here, so I'll just cover these sort of one by one and give you some sense of the individual moving parts that are within this healthcare purchasing and coverage reform. So we know that there's a number of opportunities for Minnesota to build on our successful initiatives. We've talked about many of those here, both in terms of where we've had successes, in particular with our integrated health partnerships, and some of our challenges, in particular as we look at access, reimbursement rates, et cetera. So the first part of the proposal is really leveraging, I think, on what we've done well in the healthcare administration, and that is our integrated health partnerships. For those that are less familiar with that, that is an arrangement that we have where we are working more closely with the providers, typically large care systems, but also small rural providers, and having a much more engaged conversation with them about how we can do better, how we can save money, how we can improve outcomes. There's oftentimes very specific sort of cost and quality outcomes that we're looking for, and creates opportunities for those integrated health partnerships to share in the benefit of improving the health and lowering the cost for the clients. As part of that, what we'd like to do is consolidate some existing payments that are out there that will make it easier for the health for the IHPs to better leverage the dollars that are available or encourage other organizations. As an example, those that might be involved in healthcare homes. It provides them a better opportunity and I think a more streamlined approach to how to engage the agency in terms of lowering costs and improving quality for the clients that they're serving. So the simplified structure really encompasses sort of a care coordination approach, allowing these entities sort of better access to the dollars that are available out there in healthcare homes and other kinds of programs. It would also allow us to better utilize data so that these facilities can do better care coordination. As an example, there would be better alerts for better care alerts. And this would also allow us to have access to 90% match because there is a technology component to this proposal where we could receive 90% match from the federal government. This particular part of the proposal has a savings of $9.2 million in 18 and 19 and a $34.1 million savings in 20 and 21. Moving on then, we have a dental component to this proposal. I think we've talked considerably here in this committee and others where we believe that we have ways to improve access to dental. It is an area where we have concern. It's not an area that we score very well, I think, as a state. And so we're looking for better ways to improve access to dental for the clients that we serve. This proposal, in essence, increases the base rate for all dental providers by 54%. And the way that we do that is really in two or three main ways. One is to simplify the administration of the dental program itself. We've had several meetings with stakeholders. One of the key areas of concern is the complexity around just the basic administrative functions that the dental providers need to perform in order to get paid. By going through a competitive bid process and really narrowing down the entities that these dental providers need to work with down to one or two, it will simplify the administrative processes on their end, thereby reducing the administrative costs on the dental side and allowing them to reinvest those dollars back into the program, or in essence lowering their costs allows them to have better margins on the existing rates that they have. In addition, then, as part of this, we'll be repurposing some of the additional dollars that are already out there in the system that are intended to enhance or payment in order to address access issues. This would be payments around critical access dental, and basically we would be taking the dollars that are currently allocated to very specific dental providers today and moving those dollars so that they're available for all dental providers. And again, the goal here is to invest in reform in ways that just creates greater number of dental providers to participate in MA and Minnesota care. Next, we have a proposal on long-acting reversible contraceptives. This is a proposal that allows the agency to, in essence, bulk purchase on behalf of providers in order to make these particular devices more affordable to the providers, thereby making it easier for them to make available to the clients. So we're not changing any coverage policy here. What we're simply doing is taking what is a high-cost product from the providers. They're already receiving sort of a sort of pre-structured rate in order to provide services to clients. So to the extent that within that sort of bundled payment, to the extent that we can lower costs within that, then those are dollars that then can be made available directly to the provider. So in essence, either improving the profitability or sort of the bottom line to the providers as they as they're serving their clients. And this proposal then would, in essence, put DHS in a position of making these what are referred to as long-acting reversible contraceptives. It's allowing us to sort of group purchase, use a stronger purchasing power to make those less expensive to the providers. Then there are a few proposals here that are getting at trying to reduce disparities and reduce the gaps in coverage. And some of these have been talked about in committee prior, so probably won't be a surprise to some. And the first would be eliminating the Minnesota coverage gap. This is a gap by where if a client is unable to enroll and pay their premium all in advance of the next month, they in essence end up with a gap in coverage. So as an example, if a client is trying to enroll on February 27th, the likelihood of them being able to establish their full eligibility and pay their premium is relatively low. What this proposal does is it allows us to establish the coverage in the month in which they apply, so that way we could go back to February 1st in the same way that we provide retro coverage for folks in MA. So it's really just aligning in some ways how the other public program enrollment works. This does have a cost of $427,000 in fiscal year 18 and 19 and just over $1 million in fiscal year 20 and 21. There's also something known as the family glitch. This is where eligibility sometimes for one client is driven by other family members. And this has to do with an affordability standard that is out there in law. And sometimes dependents sort of can get caught into what might be deemed affordable for one person in the family, and this is typically where you may have an employer coverage situation where for perhaps the primary subscriber, the employee, that coverage may be affordable, but it's not necessarily affordable to the entire family, yet the eligibility for Minnesota Care at this point is based on the affordability at the employee level. Sometimes you'll find that employee premiums, as an example, are reasonable relative to the income of that employee, but in order to carry the family coverage, it can be quite expensive. So again, it's simply allowing us to eliminate a situation where someone is caught in this potential family glitch situation. Just to be clear, this does require a waiver, so we will have to work with the federal government and then report back to the legislature on how best to resolve that issue. Moving on, there's also coverage for foster children. This proposal will allow children in foster care who do not receive the Title IV-E benefits to be enrolled in MA automatically, similar to children that are receiving the Title IV-E. We know that while we can do this automatically for the 4-E, despite the fact that the non-4-E children oftentimes are eligible for Medicaid, we don't have a way to automatically enroll them. This is just a way to ensure that that there isn't just basic administrative barriers that are in place that are resulting in the lack of coverage. And by us doing the automatic enrollment, then we'll be assured that folks that are generally eligible for Medicaid are receiving coverage through that program. Moving on, there's also a proposal for improving access to healthcare coverage for people who are involved in the criminal justice system. In essence, this would provide some resources at the state of Minnesota. In essence, some people who can work with those that are involved in the state justice system to interact with them prior to discharge, to assess whether or not they would be eligible for MA upon discharge from a state correctional facility. Oftentimes, folks that are involved with the justice system can be suffering from mental or chemical health issues, so it's very important that if they are eligible for Medicaid, that we get them into those programs as soon as we can, and if we can intervene before the discharge, then we'll have, I think, better results in terms of ensuring that they are indeed enrolled and receiving the appropriate services. And lastly, as part of this proposal, Mr. Chair, and to members of the committee, there is aligning an application assistant payments proposal. And in essence, this makes the reimbursement for assisters that are out there as they're working with clients on MA and Minnesota Care, it simply makes those payments equivalent. Today, somebody who is assisting under MA only receives $25, where for other programs it would be $75, and it just simply makes both the programs worth $75. Of course, you know, from an assister perspective, they have no idea the eligibility of someone prior to helping them. So as they're working with these clients, they don't know what ultimately their reimbursement rate is going to be until an eligibility determination is made. This just helps the assisters know that for everyone that they're working with, regardless of which public programs that they would fall under, that they will be reimbursed at the $70 level. Mr. Chair, that covers this particular section. Would you like me to move on?
Questions?
Okay. The next proposal then is aimed at increasing provider rates for preventative care and mental health. This is on page 107 and 108. This is really getting at two critical areas for public programs, one being primary care and the other being for mental health services. This is providing a 5% increase on fee-for-service and medical assistance. And really there's two things that we're trying to do here. We're trying to maintain a robust preventative care network through this proposal. In addition, we're also trying to emphasize that we want to continue to invest in the mental health system. It's a very fragile system with very small margins, and this is really just an investment into that system, ensuring that, again, we have a that we are investing in primary care and mental health, which are two very important parts of the public health care programs. Our next proposal is investing in modernizing payment for our safety net providers. This is a proposal, this will be page 92 through 94. This has been a proposal that we've been working on for quite some time. This is developed in collaboration with the FQHCs and the Rural Health Centers. In essence, this is updating the cost structure that we use to reimburse these entities. For those who have been involved in some of our reimbursement processes historically, we've been doing a lot to try to modernize our rate structures. We've worked a lot with the FQHCs, with the Hospital Association, to try to make our rates more current, more appropriate to the services that are being delivered, and as transparent as we possibly can. So, as I indicated, this is really directed at the FQHCs and the RHCs, and just for some perspective, the current cost structure is based on 2001. So you can imagine over the last 15 years, there has been significant shifts in the kinds of services being performed by these organizations, and we just want the rates to simply reflect that. Then moving on, Mr. Chair, and to members of the committee, there has been talk about this. This is the new Minnesota healthcare buy-in option. So the specifics around this proposal, I think, have been pretty well discussed, but let me just hit a couple highlights for the committee again. It's my right page here. So this proposal is asking for a one-time investment of $12 million. This is to provide the agency the startup costs that it needs. I think as we've discussed, the idea here is that there is a QHP-like product or program available on the exchange. It would operate like a QHP. It would be a silver and gold product. In essence, running on the infrastructure of the existing Minnesota Care program, but functioning like a qualified health plan. This option would provide the consumers in the individual market with a more affordable option. As I mentioned, that there would be a silver and a gold product available. Because it does act like a QHP, it would be eligible for tax credits. And the agency is estimating that approximately 100,000 lives would likely come into this type of product. Again, I know that this has been well vetted. Options like this have been talked about at the Healthcare Financing Task Force. I know that there's also been other hearings, and Mr. Chair certainly would be happy to get into some of the details, and we've got other folks here in the audience. We can go, you know, as get into whatever details you'd like, but that sort of was the highlights, I think, from prior conversations.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Say, on these figures in here, where does the reserve show up for these policies?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so this, in essence, is a fully insured product. So in the same way that a health plan is underwriting for existing fully insured products, the state isn't necessarily carrying the liability for the program. Again, it in all for intents and purposes is a qualified health plan. So once the startup costs are largely there to get some of the basic infrastructure in, to manage the enrollment and eligibility aspects of it, to get the communications out the door. But once that process is complete, it's really handed off to the health plans that from there would then carry, you know, that product like they would any other.
Representative Bloonan.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, so I'm looking at the, you know, our move over to the Affordable Health Care Act and some of the actuarial assumptions that they made as far as what people's behavior would be. And some of those obviously didn't pan out even close. And so we are where we're at right now with the big premium spikes and things like that. So walk me through if we run into something even remotely close to that. It may not be that egregious, but your number of people is small, so you've got a small group impact. If all of a sudden you end up with a group of adverse selection, and the claims exceed what the premium collected is, where does that money come from?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so again, it really is a fully insured product. So the health plans would be the one that would be carrying that risk in the same way that they carry the risk today for Medicare and for Minnesota Care. There has been, as an example, there has been talk about, you know, whether the health plans are profitable or not profitable to the extent that their current rates meet the demands of the citizens that they're serving. It is ultimately up to the health plan to determine whether or not the rates that they're willing to provide that product for are meeting the demands of the program. And to the extent that they're not, the health plans are the ones that carry that burden. That said, I mean, there certainly are scenarios by where, you know, you could consider a self-insured type product. That wouldn't be outside of the realm of possibilities. But I think, you know, at least initially, that would not be, you know, our first attempt. I think our first attempt would be, again, to try to keep it as similar as we can to the way Medicaid and Minnesota Care operates. And that would be a fully insured product. And I think ultimately, if that fails, then maybe we would look at some other kind of risk arrangements, whether we would carry the reinsurance or the risk, whether a third party, there are third party organizations that, you know, that will reinsure, or whether we would want to, you know, have a preference to direct that back to the health plans.
Thank you. So my take of what I see on this is one of two things happens. Either that shortfall is going to fall on the taxpayers to make that up, and I don't see how this would be different than what we have in the individual market right now, except this is even more potentially dangerous because in individual market we have reserves that they use to pay for those shortfalls, and then making the assumptions of the higher claims going forward, they had to increase premiums to cover that. Well, in this case, they would have to go back and increase premium to capture the undercharge the year before. So that's going to be added on to the premiums, let's say, the second year or the next year. And you also, because now the actuarial realities change, that you've got to also factor that in and increase it that much more also. So it seems to me that this would be even more volatile than the individual market we're looking at right now.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that I'd love to talk to Representative Bloom offline a little bit because I think some of the assumptions are wrong. It sounds like there are reserves actually to cover any shortfalls because it's fully insured, just like we have in the self-insured market. But that was not actually my question. I just thought that some more clarification might be needed on that. My question was about the products that are being offered, the gold and the silver, and who you envision would be the purchasing group for those types of plans.
Commissioner Murat.
Mr. Chair, Representative, by purchasing, I'm assuming you mean at the client level. So we haven't necessarily made any predetermination or assumptions about sort of what the risk profile would look like at that 100,000 coming in. I know that there has been more actuary. I'm just going to look to my group. Do we have specific risk profiles? No. So No, we haven't made those assumptions. I mean, certainly that would be part of the discussion with the health plans. I mean, they're the ones, to our prior conversation, they're the ones that are going to carry the risk, so they're certainly going to want to underwrite the product based on what they think is going to come in, and that's ultimately where the negotiations occur. But again, that's very similar to the discussions that we have with the health plans today when they're trying to make some assessments about the risk profile of MA and MinnesotaCare. Particularly if you look back historically, under the expansion, there was a lot of discussion about whether the expansion population would be sicker or healthier. And I just say that, to say this under the context of that, that's a pretty regular conversation that we have with the health plans.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. When I look at it, and not being an actuary, I might make some assumptions that smart scientific people don't make in terms of leaps, but it seems like this will provide an option for people who tend to be sicker. It's not usually young, healthy people who don't ever go to the doctor who purchase gold plans, the older I get, the more, healthcare I use. And so it does seem like it would perhaps help shift some of those folks out of the individual market so that the young, healthy people who want to buy, a lower metal plan might find a more affordable option in terms of the way that it could realign the risk pool. That's not an assumption that anybody is essentially making scientifically at this point, but understanding the way that insurance markets work, I think that we can perhaps start thinking about what that means for a more affordable individual market.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple more questions along the rate line. I noticed that in the book we have here, it was saying that the average premium would be $451 a month for a silver plan. Is that, I take it that's average across all ages, and that this would be an age-banded product? How does that compare to what is, the cost for a similar plan today?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think we had that in there. Do you have that number, Mary? No, it's not in there. I don't know. I'd have to get back to you on that one. I know that there was some analysis done during the health task force that looked at just simply what are some of the comparisons between an existing MinnesotaCare program and what it would be like to move that into the individual market. So there may be some things we can extrapolate from there. I think there's a couple things to keep in mind when you think about a MinnesotaCare type product in the individual market. A lot of what's being leveraged are both administrative efficiencies, purchasing power, as well as reimbursement rates. So, there are things that just naturally make it cheaper, but we can certainly get you some comparisons or try to get you some comparisons.
Thank you. I just had a question to follow up on Representative Fisher's question. You had just talked about the 100,000 folks who you think may migrate into this MinnesotaCare product. Where are those 100,000 going to come from?
So, Mr. Chair, they will be coming from the individual markets. I'm not sure if you're asking about a geographic question or...
Well, I think they might be coming from the individual market, but they also might be coming from the small group market that might be being displaced into that. And that's going to make the individual market even smaller. So the problem with the individual market is that it's too small and too sick already. And we're going to make it smaller. And the answer to the last question from Representative Fisher I thought was instructive. When you said that reimbursement rates are going to be less, that reimbursement rates are less on a MinnesotaCare type product. So to the hospitals and providers out there, that is another rate cut. From people that you are currently seeing and losing money on, or maybe breaking even on, this is another move towards the BHP MinnesotaCare product that reimburses less, as you just stated to Representative Fisher, as part of the plan. So I think that people should just know flat out that that's what this is. So I'm glad that you responded in that way. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, Mr. Chair, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's one problem with government programs. They reimburse at a rate below health care costs, and they cause cost shifting. And then I have to agree with Chair Dean's comment about the draining of people away from the small group and the individual market, which is already hurting. I have an article upstairs, actually, I should send you. It's by industry experts, and they point out how Minnesota is a perfect example of everything that's wrong with the ACA in terms of producing skyrocketing premiums, draining younger, healthy people away through government programs, and then under-reimbursing the doctors and hospitals. And again, this was written by industry experts. You know, at the federal level, even the DFL, when Obamacare was passed, rejected a public option for various reasons. And, you know, I'll just give you a couple other reasons. One is, because it's a public option and has government involvement, the pressure will come from the public to keep premiums as low as possible, and politicians are subject to election, okay, not appointment, and therefore they will have a tendency to vote more and more subsidies to keep premiums reasonable or reduce reimbursement to the doctors and hospitals. Now, we look across our nation and we see that, and even state, we see some providers are refusing to accept Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rates and the people and the patients that go along with them. So the problem is, by expanding a government program, you're simply putting yourself in a position where you can say people are covered, but their access to care is actually going to go down in many cases. And if we keep reimbursing at a lower and lower rate, they might have to go to the vet in the rural areas, okay? And I know the vet has the same medicine, only stronger, right? But it's not a good alternative, in my opinion. Mr. Chair, just a follow-up comment. You know, the... when we look at government options that are put out there, well-intended, well-meaning, we see that, you know, 90% of the promises turn out to be false or just completely wrong. And I'll just give you two. When Obamacare was passed, your premiums are going down $2,500. That really didn't happen, okay? And you can, if you want your doctor, you can keep your doctor. Well, out in the rural area especially, the networks are getting smaller and smaller. We have less choice. We only have one provider in my area, and it's a blueprint network, and it has a very narrow provider. So people who normally went to doctors can no longer go to them without paying twice the deductible. So again, it all sounds roses initially, and the problem with government is they can make all these promises and then nobody loses their job. Nobody goes to jail. If I would make these types of promises on a private product and everything turned out to be opposite, I'd be put out of business, sued for fraud, and probably wind up in jail. Yet politicians can stand up and say all this stuff and it doesn't turn out, and they just keep getting paid and keeping their job. And that's the real problem with government-run health care. So do you really want to do this to one of the best health care systems in the world? Foist another underpayment government program onto the system and further damage our health care system, which is one of the best in the world? That's the question.
All right. Representative Liebling, rebuttal.
Well, it definitely needs one, I'll tell you. But that wasn't why I raised my hand in the first place. But
I automatically put you down when I...
This is good, because you should. Well, so, you know, it's really interesting to hear politicians who are passing legislation to do things in our healthcare system talk about how it's never correct. and they should go to jail if it fails. I hope people remember that when they listen to Representative
Bernie. There's a few that belong in jail. That's the ACA out there. That.
And also there seems to be some varying between the best health care in the world and what a disaster we have. I just can't figure out which you think it is. I think it depends on what day it is or, you know, how it suits the rhetoric. But anyway,
all right.
But I really wanted to talk a little bit or to ask a little bit about more about this proposal that is that the governor is making. First of all, you know, if we're talking, I think that the chair asked a valid question, which is about draining people out of the individual market. I think that what we all kind of recognize, I think, that part of the problem we have is that it is a small market and maybe a shrinking market, and that if you're going to use an insurance model and you're going to share risk, you need a big enough pool so that, you know, so that we've got healthy and sick people in it. That's how insurance works. And I just want to note that legislature just passed this farm co-op idea, and one of the things that would do, if it succeeded and if it was able to work for the farm folks, great. One of the things that does is suck more people out of the individual market, so it further destabilizes the market. That is, you guys just passed that. Representative Grimhagen, if it doesn't work out so well, if it destabilizes the market, I don't know about jail, but maybe not being elected again might be a suitable response under your proposal there.
That's
anyway,
proposal.
So what was that?
I voted for.
Okay. So the thing I think that is a plus on this proposal that's coming from the governor is that, as I understand it, Minnesota Care has a really bad network. And so this is a proposal that would certainly expand the network for anyone who's buying into it. So we're talking about this really serious problem of narrow networks. That narrow network is a feature of individual health insurance. It is. That's how insurance companies are saving costs, by lining up these narrow networks. That happens because that's a feature of insurance in the current day. Private insurance, that's what they do. They make narrow networks. So one of the advantages of this Minnesota Care buy-in is that you'd be buying into a bigger network. Another great advantage of it is that it wouldn't, you know, we're all worried about plans pulling out of the market. I've heard numerous GOP legislators say the market's already done. It's gone. There is no market. Well, this would be a plan that couldn't be pulled away. It would be there. And when the other plans decide to abandon the marketplace, people wouldn't be left high and dry. They would have a place, and this plan would not go away. That said, there are some things that I find kind of puzzling about this. And one of those, Mr. Morocco, is why in the world would we have people buy into this and then still contract with HMOs to be a middleman for this, so now you're not buying from the HMO in the individual market. Now you're buying from the HMO through the Minnesota Care buy-in. I just don't get that. I mean, I think that just adds a layer of complication again. Why can't we contract directly with providers? We talked before about the IHPs, and, you know, we're really moving in this direction. I think your answer to Representative Lunan, which was really complicated, was really about the fact that in the proposal we're still hiring HMOs to take the risk. Right? That just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Can you kind of explain why we're doing that instead of going to direct contracting, where we could have a contract, we could have a network that's as broad as Minnesota Care for sure?
Commissioner Brown.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you. So I think there's a few things. One is that we are trying to leverage an existing infrastructure for many reasons. One, as was discussed here, if we do direct contracting, then you are getting directly into who bears the risk. And to the extent that then you're shifting from an MCO kind of arrangement to a state-run arrangement, then the state certainly would be a policy decision, but would certainly need to then consider what its reserve levels would be or how it might deal with the fluctuation between what it's collecting for a premium and what it ultimately needs for the care. While we do have a very robust integrated health partnership program, it by no means is a statewide network. So what we know we have through the existing MCOs is a statewide network that we can just simply tap into. Keep in mind that this is really just a reaction to what we're hearing, which is the individual market is losing options and there are fewer and fewer opportunities. There certainly are ways to make this kind of product or program work better, but what can you stand up between April 1st and January 1st, I think is a strong consideration, or really a strong driver to trying again to leverage the existing infrastructure. The more that you change, then the more DHS has to come up with, you know, some sort of how do you then backfill for that new difference. It could be we don't have the capacity to contract with 1,200 providers throughout the state. I mean, that would just be something we don't have the infrastructure for. But if we were talking about people wanting this in 19 and 20 and 21, sure, then we can build the infrastructure necessary to replicate some of those health plan functions. You know, we want the disease case management, you know, kinds of functionality. Could we replicate that by January 1st? Not as likely, but, you know, if we had 18 months or 24 months and we knew that was the will of the legislature and the governor, sure, then we could start to build towards those things. But keep in mind that, you know, there are a lot of things that need to happen between April 1st and January 1st. We need to work some of this out with the federal government. We need to just, you know, stand up a program, and I think that's just easier to do. But as I mentioned in my initial response, that isn't the only way that it has to be done. This is just where we would start. Ultimately, you know, if there's something else that we think would work better and we could stand it up by January 1st, we would certainly be open to doing that. And to the extent that the legislature would have specific preferences, we'd be happy to incorporate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly to follow up. So as I'm understanding you, Mr. Marco, so this isn't intended as sort of the be-all and end-all. It's really a response to the crisis that we're in. And that this is something that, again, that could work, could be implemented, and would sort of provide something that Minnesotans would not be left high and dry. And it would solve the network problem for everyone and or for people, especially in rural Minnesota, where they're having these tremendous difficulty actually accessing care. Is that kind of accurate? So that even though I think this issue about the payment rates, that's a very serious issue, and one that needs to be dealt with. Maybe those rates need to be raised. But have I sort of gotten the gist of what we're trying to do here?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. It is, you know, what can we accomplish? And I do think that the rates are a fair question and a fair point, Representative. I mean, even if you think about our prior proposal, we are asking to raise rates in primary care and mental health. It's not uncommon for us to be working with the providers, even on this proposal. I mean, it's been clear that there are providers that have approached us and said they're very concerned about the rates. So those are conversations we're very used to having. We've done that in all of the rebasing discussions. We've done that in all kinds of different lines of care. We've done that around durable medical equipment, around transportation, around PCAs. I mean, we are always talking about rates. So to the extent that we're trying to find a balance between making sure that the providers have sufficient resources to provide the service, but also at the same time trying to make at least something available to the citizens of Minnesota, that's the balance that's trying to be struck here, you know, in the first year. And if people want to then, you know, think about things like reimbursement in the second and third year, those are certainly always on the table, and we can always make those kinds of adjustments.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we need to remember that Minnesota Care has been around for 25 years, and it started as a bipartisan effort. The gang, I can't remember if it was 7 or 8, Republicans and Democratic legislators actually came up with it because they were hearing from so many constituents who were working, but they earned just too much to get on that medical assistance and could not in any way find anything in the private market that would that they could afford to offer them or their family coverage. And for 25 years, it's been a proven product. It's used more in rural Minnesota than it is in the metro just because of income disparities. But it's proven to be solid and reliable, and given people whose employers don't offer health insurance, a really solid product with a network that's worked and prices that have worked in terms of the cost sharing with its somewhat sliding fee over time. And so to me, this seems like a really reasonable step forward to put another offer on the table when we've got markets that are really shifting. And, you know, the co-op thing may work just beautifully, or they may stumble as they try and figure out how to become insurers. And but here we're going to have something that's proven, effective, and serves people in every single one of our communities for 25 years. And to me, this is probably the most solid option that you can offer in a short-term period. And I'm wondering, Mr. Morocco, can you tell me how many lives are currently in Minnesota Care and what's been the peak over time? Do you have a sense of that?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so I don't have exact historical numbers. We're at about 100,000 right now. I could certainly get you an exact number. Some historical numbers would be a little bit deceptive because Minnesota Care had a different income range. So prior to the ACA going up to 275, you would have seen, and prior to the expansion, you would have seen higher numbers in Minnesota Care. I would say about 130, see if I got any, maybe 140 would be sort of pre-ACA, mm-hmm. and now we've fluctuated somewhere in the, you know, 100, 110,000, something like that.
Well, thank you. That was kind of my recollection, is that we'd gone up higher, and then we transferred some to MA with the MA expansion, and, you know, that to me is another signal that it's a pretty resilient program. It's proven it can ramp up and scale and work and still continue to offer people close to home care at an affordable price, and that's what I hear people want. And so I think we ought to give this a try. We're giving some other things a try, and this one I think will enable a lot of people who quit us that are incoming off of Minnesota Care to have continuity of care with the providers locally that they're used to going to, and provide the kind of coverage that they're used to getting. Thank you.
Representative Murphy. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, I'm looking at the table, and one of the things that strikes me in the presentation before the table is that you're going to be asking for legitimately a 1332 waiver. But yet I don't see, I understand that in past waivers have been in the range of $250,000. I'm just wondering what your estimation is for the 1332 waiver in this case and why it isn't accounted for in your budget.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair, I'm just looking. I may call our Medicaid Director, Marie Zimmerman, here to answer that specific question.
Welcome back to the committee. Ms. Zimmerman, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marie Zimmerman, I'm the Medicaid Director at DHS. I think the amount just for the 1332 waiver submission was about $400,000 of that total that was in there. And that's for essentially the actuarial analysis that's required for the submission of the 1332 waiver. The other costs in the budget page are related to administrative and systems costs related to bringing up the buy-in option.
So, Mr. Chair, and to you, then, it's not in the table, or it is?
Ms. Zimmerman.
I mean, there certainly are components.
Okay, thank you. I think we got it. Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. It's in the line that's labeled actuarial support for managed care rate setting. Part of that is of the 1332 waiver submission actuarial analysis, and part of that is just the rate development that will need to occur.
Mr. Chair, and how much is it estimated for 1332 then?
I believe that, Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe that portion of it is about $400,000 of that, $650,000.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Morocco, so this proposal requires plans participating in MA and MinCare to other to offer Minnesota buy-in option. How does that work with a statewide procurement system?
Commissioner Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so as you described, anyone who is serving public programs would be required to engage the agency on building a QHP silver and gold product. But, of course, from there we would negotiate as we do with any of the health plans under the Minnesota Healthcare Program process, meaning we're going to negotiate rates and terms and admin structures and the like.
Mr. Chair, and so, Mr. Morocco, the assumption that I'm making from your answer then is that you would have to opt into the bid, but only if you were awarded the bid?
Commissioner Morocco.
Mr. Chair, no, Representative, I would say that if you are bidding on the public health care programs, you are going to engage the agency on creating a Minnesota Care buy-in option for the individual market.
Mr. Chair,
if it helps, there's a similar rule, Representative. You may be familiar with Rule 101. It's a similar kind of situation where in order to serve state employees, you also have to be serving public programs. So it's a similar kind of structure where the state tries to leverage participation by really engaging those that are involved in the larger programs like Medicaid to be engaged in other state programs like the state benefit program that you participate in. This would be a similar thing.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco, what happens if there is no advanced premium tax or cost-sharing subsidies?
Commissioner Morocco.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure if you mean whether or not we would still provide products. There are no subsidies, so the product itself will just be rated for whatever the cost need is for the program. To the extent that it's eligible for advanced payment tax credits, that will certainly be available to the client. But there isn't any explicit subsidy that comes out of the state or any other entity. The premium will be intended to pay for the cost of the program. Did I answer the question?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco, I think you get a sense that the din in the room really went down, because my next question is, and maybe it may be obvious to them and maybe not to others, but has DHS spoken with the plans about this this pricing?
Commissioner Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, not specific to this proposal. Certainly there's been talk, as I mentioned before, the healthcare access or the healthcare task force. There has been a lot of discussion about Minnesota Care, whether to expand it, whether to shrink it. So there's certainly been conversations on that level, but not specifically for the purposes of this proposal.
Mr. Morocco, Mr. Chair, so is there any guarantee that the PHP MinCare network would be the same as the public program provider network?
Commissioner Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that certainly would be the intent. Again, we're trying to take advantage of the existing infrastructure for the public health care programs. So our intent would be that the Minnesota Care network that is currently available for those in the, you know, up to 200%, that would be the same network then that is available to this QHP product for the 200-plus FPL.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco, what and how will invoice and billing for the premiums be handled?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't know if that has been explicitly determined. I think that would be part of the negotiations that we would have with the plans. I think, again, conceptually, this being a QHP, but the plans would be doing the billing, similar to what you would find on a product on the exchange. The plans are making that available. the exchange is the one that's making sort of the buying option or sort of the buying process available to the citizen. But once that product is selected, so this would be standing next to whatever other products might be out there, and then a client would then select this relative to anything else. That information would go over to the plan, and they would administer it like any other QHP plan, administer the tax credits and so forth. So I think that's sort of the point at which it sort of leaves kind of the realm of DHS, meaning it's left our infrastructure. We have, in essence, used our purchasing power to create the product, but we're not necessarily, you know, administering it the same way that we'd be administering a Minnesota Care program today.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco. Mr. Chair, it just greatly concerns me that, you know, given the answers given, that we're still working to reconcile Minnesota Care on the DHS system, that now we're, in a sense, infusing additional problems on top of it. So I'll just leave it at that, but I think it's fraught with some disaster.
All right. Thank you, Representative Albright. We have Representative Considine, Lunan, and Haley, and then I think we'd like to move on beyond the Minnesota Care expansion. So Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, Representative Runegan, I do not want to be your cellmate. We keep talking about this and these problems, and yet the rest of the developed world has managed to solve them, and they do so with universal health care. It works everywhere else it is, and it has over a 70% approval rating in those countries. I applaud this as a short-term gap in an emergency situation, but I really believe that we need to start looking long-term at universal health care.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the universal health care comment, that does not address the cost of health care. That just redistributes who's paying for it. If we, in our discussion about health care right now, you know, we're all trotting around feeling good about the big increase in number of insured people. We have a substantial decrease in number of people who are paying for health care. And that's where the rubber meets the road. The Mr. Morocco, this is just a basic question regarding, you know, the two biggest problems in health care right now are the cost of health care and accessibility to health care. When we talk about accessibility to health care, I'd be curious to get your reaction to the idea that, you know, if networks are contended to be designed to keep costs down, then maybe we as legislators should take a look at mandating that what insurance carriers, the plans have to do, is if someone in outstate, Laverne, Minnesota, wherever, goes to a non-network provider, all the carrier has to do is, and in statute, only has to pay reasonable necessary costs, has to pay what they're paying an in-network doctor. Now that consumer makes a decision when they decide to go to a network doctor or not to a network doctor, whether or not they want to pay that difference, if there's a difference. In my checking around, I found instances where non-network doctors were charging less than network doctors, and the insurance company were still assigning a 20% punitive that, well, you went out of bounds. You didn't go into our network or into our preferred situation. And so if, in fact, it is for cost containment, let's just go to that. And the accessibility thing is addressed instantly. I was curious to get a reaction from you on that idea.
Commissioner Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, there certainly is a possibility that if someone goes out of network, it could be cheaper. I'm not sure that would play out, you know, across statewide.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the other thing, too, to consider is that not only do we want people to access a doctor, but we also want them to access the right care at the right time for the right price. So, you know, to the extent that clients are sort of self-directing themselves outside of a network, that we are asking that network to better manage the client, it starts to, you know, once you get into sort of open access, what you potentially lose is the ability to manage somebody under chronic diseases, or for that primary care facility to even be aware that someone's going out of network. So to the extent that you know, they're receiving a certain type of care, they're under a certain regimen, they might be receiving a certain set of prescription drugs. If they go outside of that network, they could be duplicating those efforts. They could be getting, you know, the same test done twice. They could be getting, one doctor might prescribe a drug that's completely, you know, contradictory to what the primary care doctor is prescribing, but unbeknownst to either one of them, you know, there's multiple treatment protocols that are occurring. So it certainly is possible, and that's something we could look at. It's not something, again, I've seen in my experience, but I think there would be other reasons that we are looking for, not necessarily narrowing networks, but making sure that once somebody selects a network, that that network is doing a good job in treating the care of that client.
One final comment, Mr. Chairman. In going around talking to people, one thing I heard multiple times was a concern that there were things, tests, for instance, particularly, being prescribed that weren't necessarily weren't needed, and that it was basically a revenue generator. And that doesn't fall on the plans; that falls on the providers. I'm picking that up at that. There was an intrinsic incentive to go through and order all of these other different tests, or to move the threshold number for when you should be put on a statin, or things like that. And I mean, there's just a lot of people with their head in the trough, and I think it's still going to come down to the consumers having to do the work to shop and bring the price market back in, not a public option. I get very concerned. I just have not seen a lot of success when someone else is buying that people put in the work to create a cost-effective environment. That's just my two cents.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. On page 81 here, when you talk about the cost of this, there's a paragraph, administering the new product in Minnesota like a QHP will require ongoing funding to support call center operations, establish and maintain benefit and eligibility, develop and manage the waiver process, et cetera, providing rolling notices and communications. We just heard yesterday a long testimony and litany of concerns around enrolling in Minnesota. And it's the number one thing that I think many of us heard from our constituents over this past year is frustration. And I'd like to know where your confidence comes from to add another 100,000 people into that process.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so again, this would not be DHS being the primary administrator. We certainly would be involved, and there would be a component to enrolling in MinSure. But once the plan is, or once the client selects a plan, the way it is conceived at this point is that the plan is responsible for the administration of that program in the same way that they are today with anybody that might go through MinSure. Certainly recognizing where DHS has had issues with communications. That primarily has been around our own internal processes for MA and Minnesota Care that wouldn't necessarily be tied into the communication process that's necessary for a QHP product. But we would certainly be mindful in agreement that that would need to be corrected if we are involved in any parts of that.
Thank you, Commissioner Representative Haley. So I think we probably should move beyond that, but obviously we've got more discussion to go on BHP and where we're going to be heading in the future. So appreciate the good discussion. Please continue, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will certainly make myself available to anyone or to the committee to the extent that you want to talk about these further. That really does sort of wrap things up. If I could just mention a couple other things. There was a question about the current premiums. The statewide average premium right now in 2017 is $538. This goes to your question, Representative Fisher. And then lastly, we have a host of other proposals, and I guess for the sake of time, they're just simply noted here on this last page. There are a few that are more sort of compliance alignment type of proposals. I would direct you to the Federal Compliance and Managed Care Access, asset verification, updates to Minnesota Care MA statutes, and the MA Benefit Recovery Special Need Trust. Some others are a little bit more... are sort of are coming back from prior years. So hospital rebasing, this is something we've talked about for many years. When we have a good working relationship with the hospital association on this, it's just simply continuing that work. And then lastly, the final bullet there, the family home visiting and MA reimbursement. This has to do with prenatal and postpartum visits. So it's really just trying to create a better connection for the client as they go through the pregnancy and postpartum, that we're just creating better and more frequent touch points so we can better manage the care. With that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, certainly stand by to answer any of the questions you may have, or we can move on to some of the other financing discussions, and Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson would be joining me for that discussion.
All right, Commissioner. I don't know if other members do, but I want to talk about the provider tax sunset.
Okay.
Expansion, and I don't know if that's with Mr. Commissioner Johnson or if you want to handle that. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Chuck Johnson. I serve as Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Human Services. There are a couple of pages here that deal with the financing of the governor's budget that impact the Department of Human Services that I'll cover. The first page relates to the repealing the sunset on the provider tax and an impact on rates in medical assistance in Minnesota care. Folks are aware that the governor is proposing to repeal the sunset on the tax. The tax has been scheduled to sunset at the end of December 2019 or in the middle of fiscal year 2020. So this is the first forecast horizon in which we had to address the impacts of the change from the tax sunsetting. There was a change made in the provider tax in 2003. Prior to 2003, revenues for the providers earned from medical assistance in Minnesota care were exempted from the provider tax. 2003, that exemption was lifted, and at the same time, a rate increase was given to providers of 2%. So essentially, there was an effort made by the legislature to kind of balance out the extension of the tax with a rate increase to help providers support their service within MA and Minnesota care. In the forecast, the assumption is that when the provider tax, or if the provider tax is repealed, that the rate increase goes away as well. Because the governor is proposing to repeal the sunset of the provider tax, we have to essentially buy back the rate increase to keep it in alignment with the past practice and what was done in 2003. So that's what this budget page shows. You see obviously a large revenue increase, which is due to the continuation of the provider tax, and an offsetting cost in the general fund and healthcare access fund for the rate increase for providers in MA and Minnesota care.
So, Commissioner, that's about, just for the purposes of your budget, reinstating the sick tax is about $1 billion over a year and a half, and extending that out. And so you see that's not just the only impact is the increase in tax, but also on the rates that you've explained. On page 113, we've got refinance MA to the Healthcare Access Fund. Could you just go over what those what that exchange is, or just explain very generically what you're trying to do there at the top of page 113?
Sure, Mr. Chair. So this is another proposal in the governor's budget, which is essentially to refinance medical assistance expenditures in the healthcare access fund, using the balance in the healthcare access fund to pay for rising healthcare costs. What it does is it moves $716 million of medical assistance costs to the healthcare access fund in the fiscal year 18-19 biennium, and about $1.1 billion in 2021. Healthcare Access Fund was originally created to support MinnesotaCare, but over time has come to pay for portions of medical assistance as well. In fact, medical assistance is actually the largest expenditure now within the Healthcare Access Fund. This fits also with the changes that have happened since the Affordable Care Act, where a number of people we used to provide coverage for through MinnesotaCare are now covered under MA through the expansions of medical assistance and the increase in the number of children that are covered in MA. So what the governor is proposing to do here is to use some of that surplus, recognizing that we have rising health care costs as a percentage of our budget, and that using the Health Care Access Fund, continuing the provider tax, is a way to help us manage those health care costs relative to other needs within the overall state budget.
And Commissioner Johnson, you know, we're very interested, obviously, if we're increasing the tax by $1 billion over a year and a half, and we're draining the entirety of the Health Care Access Fund. Those are very striking numbers, particularly as the economy becomes less likely to continue to expand in a surplus, and we're more likely, we're probably closer to our next deficit than we are to the last one. You know, we're very leery about that in terms of the spending, both increasing the sick tax as well as draining the Health Care Access Fund. If we add those together, my initial math would tell me that we are not displacing all of that back within the MinnesotaCare expenditure and the MA expenditure, but that that may be, in fact, leaking into the general fund for other purposes. Can you give us some comfort that within the within the governor's budget that we're not doing that?
Mr. Chair, the entirety of the dollars that are being used on this page are to pay for medical assistance, which is to subsidize health care for low-income individuals and other individuals. That's what the Health Care Access Fund dollars are being used for.
But in fact, they're being displaced to the general fund, which has many uses.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and that aligns to other priorities within the governor's budget.
Yes, it does. All right. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner. What happens if BHP MinnesotaCare federal funding goes away?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I think that's part of the challenge that we're all facing now to complete this budget, is addressing the uncertainty of what might happen in Washington and how that might impact where we're going forward with our budget. It's a challenging question to undertake now, and I feel like personally in December I felt differently than I do now as to how quickly or what this is going to look like. I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know when it's going to happen. When are they going to repeal? What are they going to repeal? When are they going to replace? It's really hard to know right now what we're working against. What the governor has done here with his budget when he put it together is to assume that we're working under current law and that we will have decisions to make, may have decisions to make, depending on what happens in Washington. Certainly in the event that that were to happen, we would have to revisit the decisions that the governor is proposing here to figure out how we want to fund MinnesotaCare going forward.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I find it a bit of an oddity then that we have in other committees the director of MMB come before this A committee and say that they have to put a budget together based upon what we know and what's in statute and what we know. But yet in this article, what you're suggesting is that we have to put a budget together based upon what we don't know. You can't have it both ways. And so which way are you going to go on this? Either we do or we don't have the money. So it's more of a commentary, Mr. Chair, but, you know, the frustration is that the proposals cut both ways and you can't have it that way.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I don't think I'm saying that at all. I'm saying the governor based his budget on current law, which is what we know. And under current law, we do have federal money for the MinnesotaCare program. If current law changes, we may have to adjust what we're doing. And that's an ongoing process that we manage from year to year.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for your testimony. You know, on page 113, rationale and background, it says total biennial state MA expenditures are expected to increase by 18.5% from fiscal year 16-17 to fiscal year
18-19. Holy Hannah.
Do you believe that that type of an increase is sustainable in any way, shape, or form?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think that that's a fair question. I think that's part of the reason why the governor wants to continue the provider tax and use it to help with some of these expenditures, recognizing that there's a substantial growth there. I will say this. We're growing at about 4% in the families with children and adults without kids part of the budget, which is kind of the basic health care, 800, 900, some thousand people. We're growing about 7% a year for the services for people with disabilities and seniors. And that's the bigger part of the Medicaid budget. So when we're looking at where the growth is, we have to have the whole conversation as well. And part of that conversation is decisions that have been made collectively by this committee as well as the governor and others to increase costs across many parts of that part of the budget because we know there are real needs there. And we know the Best Life Alliance is coming again this year. We increased nursing home rates a couple of years ago. That's part of where you see the growth is, $300 million in the next biennium that is part of the nursing home increase that we put in a couple of years ago. Well, it doesn't mean it was the wrong thing to do, but it does mean we have to figure out how we're paying for it.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you, as a department, look at other states as far as, I mean, If I was in leadership at the department and I saw 18.5% and you quoted 5 and 7% or whatever per year, you multiply that, it's double digit. That's faster than the economy's growing, faster than personal incomes are growing. In fact, personal incomes have been flat or declining over the last 10 years, but these budgets just keep growing at double digit. And I am not denying that the need is not there for these people, okay? I've had my father-in-law was had Alzheimer's. He was over 12 years in the nursing home. And he couldn't feed or dress or do anything else for himself. But if I was in charge, well, let's put it this way. I have my own business. If my expenses were going up faster at 18.5% and my income wasn't going up that fast, I would be turning over every possible option I could to cut my expenses. Does the department, you know, really look at how can we reform this system in a way that meets people's needs, and we've got to get this increase down? I mean, is there a planning group, or do we just look at the federal law and say, well, this is where we're at, and we're going to plod forward? I mean, sometimes I think I'm in the twilight zone, to tell you the truth. Fell asleep and I woke up. Somebody said I am? No. But, 18.5% should shock all of us, I think. And so anyway, that's the question. What is the department doing to look at reforms that can still meet needs of people who are in critical situations in many cases, but bringing that growth rate down to a more manageable level?
Commissioner Johnson, I think that's a fair point. Just from the administration's policy standpoint, going to the commissioners and assistant commissioners looking for savings within their budgets. So I'm sure the governor that was part of the directive. And where have you been successful in this year's governor's budget in actually pulling out meaningful costs?
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I think it is a fair question, and I think the numbers are big, and we should all be concerned about it. In answer to the question, since about 5 years ago, we've saved over $1 billion in how we procure health care costs by doing competitive bidding, by pushing down the rates that we're paying the managed care organizations as a way to squeeze more money out of the system to bring down that cost curve. In fact, we had a year where our capitation rates actually dropped. Didn't just not go up with the cost of medical, but actually went down in an actual dollar term. That's from hardworking people in the department putting that together. Mr. Morocco talked about the integrated health partnerships that have saved us over $100 million since we started them, and some improvements we have in this budget, which will save additional money going forward. The changes in this budget to how we want to procure dental, which will help us be able to increase the dental rates, create more access without spending more money, I think fall in that category as well. We've been on a long-term course in the long-term care area over the course of more than a decade of trying to move away from institutionalization and try to move toward lower-cost services to serve people in the communities and in their homes. Those services are pretty expensive. We care for a lot of people in their communities and homes now that we didn't in the past. But it's certainly a better and less expensive way to do that, and that's been a long-term effort. Certainly Lauren Coleman has been very key in leadership over that over the last 15 years or so. In the governor's budget this year, in that area, we also have some reforms to how we pay for employments for people with disabilities and to move more to a competitive form of employment. We're not asking for more money to do that. We're asking to make changes in the money we spend now so we can reinvest it in a better way of paying for employment. Exact same thing in housing people with disabilities. We're not asking for more money. We're asking to take the money we have now and use it differently so we get more people housed independently. Those are all the efforts that we're trying to take to help to try to turn this. And I understand it's a very big number, and it's a very hard ship to turn at times because we're trying to meet a tremendous amount of need doing it. And so that those are the things that we've tried to do from the perspective of what we're doing in our budget to try to address this. I know there have been other good ideas that have been put forward, and we try to work with those where we can to share that common interest.
Finally,
just a quick follow-up.
Hagen.
Oh, thank you for that. And I want to thank the people who work hard to make those changes and to try to reform the system. But just when you see, you know, from an oversight standpoint and layperson, when you see 18.5%, I mean, I just, if it was my business, I'd say that can't happen, okay? And, you know, and then we're talking about public option, which, you know, if we can't fix what we're already doing in the government, you know, I don't think we should be looking at expanding any type of program. We should try to get a handle on what we've got already rather than, you know, expanding the problem in many cases. So that's just a final summary. But I sincerely appreciate your response and the people who've worked on this, because I know there's been changes, but sometimes it just seems the percentage just continues to grow at a rate that's unsustainable.
Thank you, Representative Greenhagen. I know that Representative Knobloch would agree. And is going to be asking us to try to reduce costs in many areas where we can, and the overall cost picture is unacceptable, not just to Representative Knobloch, not just to the many providers that have had their had to make some very difficult decisions and closed doors in some cases, particularly in greater Minnesota, but also middle-class Minnesotans who continue to try to take from their retirement and get rid of assets to try to pay their health insurance costs. The math is not working for a lot of people. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, one of the things I often think of when I think about this budget that we are charged with overseeing is that very often, and I expect it this year too, we're given a big old cut that we have to make. And we have to make really hard choices. And historically, that has led to cuts to a lot of direct service, to the point in Minnesota where the courts had to step in and say you can't cut direct service as much as you want to cut it. That's disturbing. When we cut this budget, it doesn't mean that there aren't sick people in Minnesota. It doesn't mean that there aren't elderly people in greater Minnesota who need care. It doesn't mean that there aren't people with disabilities. Add to that the federal, mandates that we have to live up to and the federal expectations we have to live up to, the Olmstead Act. These are the pressures that are on this system. It's not a matter of having all this choice. It's a matter of being faced with the facts of who we are serving with our health and human services budget and to serve these people in a way that provides them dignity and independence and that provides their caregivers a decent wage. And so when we look at this budget and when we look to cut this budget, which I anticipate we're going to have to do, that's what we have to think about. Those are the choices we're making. And so to flippantly say that we're just spending money hand over fist and there's no savings in here when I'm flipping through and seeing all kinds of savings and efficiencies is, I think, not a fair picture. But I did want to get back to the comments that we were talking about with regard to the provider tax, because one of what we're talking about in here is how we're paying for our healthcare system and how we're paying for people who aren't able to access healthcare right now in a way that serves their needs the best. And so we're trying to be creative. And one of the things that's been successful about the way Minnesota has dealt with healthcare reform is that we've always paid for it. We've always approached it with If we're going to provide this, we're going to pay for it, and we're not going to put the rest of the state's budget at risk. We're not going to put education at risk. We're not going to put transportation at risk. We are going to fund this in a way that is fair and broad-based. And historically, that has been through mechanisms of taxes on health care, through hospitals and small group health plans, individual health plans, and the provider tax. And the provider tax, interestingly enough, when it got put into place to fund Minnesota Care, was the mechanism that was the most broad-based tax in our system. And so we asked our small employers for years to help fund the MSHA system through a tax, which we aren't able to levy on large employers because of ERISA. But by putting this provider tax compromise into place, what we did was say we can get revenue from people who are using the healthcare system in order to fund a healthier healthcare system. And the benefit of a healthier healthcare system is reduced uncompensated care. Minnesota has some of the lowest uncompensated care rates in the nation. And the drop in uncompensated care very much exceeds that 2% tax that we see. We also created a system where the tax is levied through a pass-through, so the payer, it can get bundled into the rates and the payer pays for it. So it's really a way to get at the broadest use of utilizers in the state of Minnesota, not to in any way penalize the group of providers. And it's also a way of moving forward. I mean, the other choice that we had would be to reinstate the taxes that we've levied on small groups in the past, and we know but that has always been a very narrow tax that has hit our small group market, our small employers, very hard. And as Minnesotans, as legislators, we worked real hard to try to find creative ways to lessen that burden over the years. And so making sure that we still are looking for broad-based funding sources to pay for our healthcare system so that we're not putting the rest of our budget at risk and we're not putting these vulnerable people at risk is really important. So I want us to think about healthcare in terms of who we're serving and how we're serving them. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Liebling, and then I think, Commissioner, you got about six slides with better government, so we want to make sure we get to that. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just, to what Representative Halverson was just saying, I just want to say, this is our business. Representative Greenhagen, you've been here quite a while now, and I keep hearing you say, oh, I'm just a layperson, and, oh, as though you're hearing this for the first time. You've been on these committees a long time. I don't know how long, but just slightly less than I have. And, as legislators, we have the opportunity and maybe the responsibility to come forward with proposals to save money.
I have them.
Well, great. Put them out there because, I mean, the people in the agencies are working very hard to do this. I think Mr. Johnson did a great, quick rundown of some of the work that they've been doing. And the bottom line here, and I think he said it, is that we have growing numbers of people who need services. Most of this money is going for the elderly and people with disabilities. And we hear bills in the two health committees all the time where everybody wants to raise rates for people and help people with disabilities. We just had a spend down bill that Representative Zerwas brought. I don't know if it hasn't come here, but it came to the policy committee. And everybody is very concerned about that issue and wants to fill those gaps. Well, guess what? It costs money. It grows the budget. So we have really tough decisions to make, and it isn't that somebody's being irresponsible. And sure, there's always some waste in the system, and we need to always be going after that waste, and I think the department is trying to do that because nobody wants a single taxpayer dollar to be wasted when we have incredible needs. And we don't want it to be wasted anyway. Why would anyone? So, but I'm just getting a little tired of hearing the same rhetoric about, oh, we should be more like a business and all that stuff. Because guess what? Government is not a business. We can learn a lot from business. We should try to, I think the governor's now saying move at the speed of business. Absolutely. But we are not a business. We have to meet other needs. It's not about a bottom line. It's about making sure that we have, people getting enough services so that they can participate in our economy. I mean, this is so much bigger than what businesses have to worry about. So, you know, let's just be a little realistic and understand we're talking about health care for our constituents, our friends and neighbors, our family members who desperately need that care and many of whom cannot function without it. And, yes, it's growing because our population, you and I are part of the problem. Representative Gernhagen, you know, we're the older wave of the population.
One of us is the problem.
Well, I won't ask you which one, but, you know, so you know, we're not, we're in this state, we are not willing to put the elderly on an ice floe or the disabled. You know, so, you know, let's, we need to work together to try to get the budget under control. Why? Because we want to keep providing the services that people desperately need. But, you know, come on. This is your business. You know, don't keep telling us that you're just a citizen and you've just wandered in and, oh, my goodness, how can these things be happening? I'm just kind of tired of
Ms. Jarrett,
Representative Gernhagen, and then we're going to get to...
Yeah, I'll just say I respectfully disagree with many of her comments. Not all of them, but many of them.
All right. To be continued, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm going to cover the slides on the better government. This part of our budget really addresses the tools that we need to be able to do our work well and to be able to provide the oversight to the work that we do to ensure the best outcomes for people and to ensure that we're spending money in the way that we should be. We spend $16 billion a year in our department between state and federal dollars. It's a large sum of money. And it's spent through many complicated mechanisms and making sure that those are all handled correctly and the money goes where it's supposed to and gets the outcome we want for people is really what we mean when we want to do government better. I'll skip over a couple of these, Mr. Chair, just in the interest of time. The first proposal, which is on pages 190 to 194 of your budget book, is the operating adjustment for the department. This is the basic money to continue our operations, to continue the staffing levels that we have now based on our projections of what staffing costs and operating costs will be going into the future. The biggest expenditure, 85% of the 45 or so million you see here, is for the direct care and treatment side of our operation. As folks are aware, direct care and treatment, about 4,500 employees across 175 sites across Minnesota. When we aren't able to maintain our staffing levels in direct care and treatment, what happens is we either have to reduce census in order to be able to care for less people because we don't have the staff to be able to carry for the number that we normally have capacity for, or somehow compromise treatment or compromise safety of our staff. And I think we've seen what's happened over the last few years when we have had understaffing situations and have kind of robbed Peter to pay Paul and created crises in various parts of our direct care and treatment. We need to maintain our staffing in that part of the agency, or it has repercussions for the 12,000 very vulnerable people we serve. About $9 million of the cost on this slide is for the central office staff. These are the staff that work to distribute actually the vast majority of the money that we distribute and to oversee the services and do the work that I was describing to Representative Brunhagen a few minutes ago. What work do we do? And there's a lot of different things that we do, but just to throw out a few examples. We train 950 county workers in classroom and 3,800 online on SNAP and cash programs last year. That's basic program integrity work. Ensure that the county workers understand the policies they're implementing. It's a very basic function that we do to ensure that our programs are operating, getting the outcomes that we desire. We also obviously do a lot of work with the healthcare part of our budget. And a significant part of that is claims and 126 million claims that are processed every year that require, some of them do go automatically, but a lot of work by our staff in order to ensure those claims are being handled correctly. We also have staff within that area that I would call out to work on third-party liability, and that's essentially ensuring that we're always the payer of last resort. And last year, we avoided about $900 million in cost by the third-party liability efforts that we put into this, and recovered another $60 million on the back end where we did make payments, but we were able to identify a third-party payer. Those are the important part kind of work that our staff do that we want to maintain going forward, and that this request would allow us to continue.
Excuse me, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to wait until he's done.
Until he's finished with the presentation? Please continue, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal addresses a request for modernizing the aging technology at the Department of Human Services, ask for $4.5 million each year in the next biennium and $10 million a year in 2021. This really will help us to continue our work that we're doing on what we call Integrated Service Delivery System. This is a system that we've been working on really with the counties, tribes, and other stakeholders to kind of get started over the last couple of years. Ultimately, it would replace our PRISM system, which supports the Child Support Program, MAXIS system, which does eligibility, SSIS, which is a case management child welfare system, and MEC Squared, which supports child care programs, and also the modernization of our MMIS claims system, which, as I mentioned earlier, is a system that processes all those $12 billion or so dollars that we spend in the Medicaid program. These systems are very old. Our MAXIS system was brought up in the early 90s. MMIS has been around longer than that and was refreshed in the mid-90s. SSIS and PRISM were both developed in the mid-90s. So we're talking about systems that are over 20 years old. Mostly these are mainframe systems. Some of them you're familiar with the green screen technology. The legislature did provide funding for what we were then calling system modernization, but we're now calling part of our integrated service delivery system in 2013. We have gotten started using that money, again, working with the counties, so really helping us define that vision of what we want the technology to be to support where we want our business to go. And that's really a person-centered, integrated way of delivering human services. And so that's the piece that we've been working on. This money would help us to do some additional ongoing work in that area. MMIS, our claims system, we actually, in order to maintain our federal certification, need to continue to work on that system as well and modernize it. We've started some work on that on a handful of projects that will help us move forward. We're kind of doing that on a piece-by-piece basis of identifying places where we can modernize pieces of the MMIS system and also doing evaluation of kind of the most challenging piece of that, which is the COBOL code that sits at the middle of that claim system, 28 million lines of code, and whether or how we're going to transfer that over to a more modern form of technology to continue the hard work that the MMIS system does around all the payments that we make within the healthcare area. This, on pages 209 to 210, is a request to strengthen the fraud investigation work that we do within medical assistance and our child care program. This is a request for 18 FTEs, but it actually pays for itself in terms of the money that we would recover back by having the additional staff to work in these two areas. This would add 10 staff to our medical assistance fraud investigation area we call SIRS, Surveillance Integrity Review System, 7 investigators, a data analyst, attorney, and a supervisor. This is the area that looks at provider fraud, money that's not being spent correctly, claims that are being embellished, and that kind of thing. We really need to put more focus in this area of our work on some of the providers that are higher risk providers, and a lot of those are some of the smaller ones within some of the home and community-based services that are kind of spread out around and a little bit harder to identify where the expenditures are going. So this would really assist with doing more work in that area within the medical assistance program. This proposal also asks for 6 investigators for the fraud prevention area in child care. I'm sorry, 8 for in the child care program. We've identified and already taken action on, and there have been some prosecutions on child care fraud within child care centers, and that we have additional ones that we've identified for further investigation. We need more resources to pursue that, always working with local law enforcement on it. We also want to start working more in the child care area of not just pursuing the criminal cases, but also the administrative remedies and the paybacks that we need to do on our side in order to ensure that our child care assistance dollars are going to providers that are actually providing care for children. The request on pages 205 to 206, strengthening integrity and data practices. This is a request for 2 FTEs to strengthen the work that we do around data practices. We've assessed additional risk that we are facing in the data privacy area relative to our capacity right now to really manage it. Some of this relates to some new federal regulations around HIPAA. some pretty high fines that have been applied to other public entities for HIPAA violations, and our need to get more organized in the sense of having a better policy, better support to our business areas on how to develop the controls that we need in order to ensure that we're maintaining data privacy, and to provide a better framework for how we do this work within the agency. We only have 4 FTEs right now dedicated to the task of data privacy across the entire agency. And finally, there are some other proposals that are listed on this slide. The one that I would highlight is that we are bringing back a proposal for licensing fees for the home and community-based services. This is a follow-up from the 2013 legislature in which the legislature created new standards for HCBS licensing, provided us some direct funding through the general fund, also put some interim rates in place, asked us to come back in 2016 with a proposal. We did that. It didn't pass. We are in need of having the additional funding. Right now, we're only able, with the resources we have, to visit the HCBS providers once every 4 years, and that's really a wholly inadequate oversight for these providers that are carrying out in the community for a lot of vulnerable people. This proposal would allow us to both provide oversight once every 2 years and also to meet the investigative needs on maltreatment investigations. Fully 2/3 of our investigations for maltreatment are in HCBS settings. There's a couple of items there that I won't go into unless folks have questions on them. So we'll just leave a couple minutes if you have any time for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I wanted to tell you how much I appreciate your remarks about people having to dig into their retirements and because of medical bills. 2009 was sitting around a table in Denmark with my wife's relatives, and I mentioned that 60% plus of bankruptcies in this country were because of medical. Their mouths all just dropped open, and they said, look at me, when they finally could talk, and said, first they get sick, then you take their money? And they were just appalled because, of course, that doesn't happen in Denmark.
All right. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, when I heard the word COBOL, I realized I laughed out loud. It's shocking to me that we are still asking our state agencies to work with such antiquated equipment, and I think that this is a place where our value, the value that we hear about running government more like a business, is where we could really put our money where our mouth is, because we are creating such inefficiency by not providing for the proper technology to do the work that we are asking our agencies to do. And so I'm really looking forward to a future budget meeting where we don't have to hear about the COBOL platform that we are trying to ask our people to cobble together as all the COBOL programmers are retiring.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In an earlier hearing, we heard how the department currently is only able to investigate 10% of the serious maltreatment and abuse reports that it gets. It's proposing to add some additional staff, so it'll get above that, but nowhere near, I think, the community expectations. And then I saw on page 199 there's a change item dealing with fines for maltreatment. And they're still in the, you know, $1,000 to $5,000 range, which, given what some of these healthcare providers are being paid, seems like a slap on the wrist in some circumstances. And I must say, when I read in the paper about some pretty really terrible situations that unfortunately have happened, and then you see a fine of $2,000, it really makes you feel like we're not sticking up for those people, and I'd be interested in working with the department and others on how can we best balance this, because I think if there's a serious threat of fines, that makes people take it much more seriously as well.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And just lastly, Commissioner, the legislative auditor conducted a high-profile review of the eligibility determination system and found a very high error rate and perhaps as much as $200 million in misallocated costs from the state government to
pay for programs that people didn't qualify for, in which we had initiated legislation to go back and check to see if people actually were qualified in a periodic data match. Last time I checked, that had not yet been started. Has it since been started, and has the governor prioritized this to the level of adding staff or looking for some of that money?
Mr. Chair, the periodic data match has not been started. We're continuing to look at options for how we can manage the federal tax information within that functionality. That became the holdup. We haven't yet figured out whether we have a solution that we can do. We know it's going to be a lot of work to manage the FTI within the system, and so we're trying to prioritize when we do that work, which needs to happen prior to implementing the periodic data match. We also started some conversations around alternative ways of potentially doing the periodic data match that might avoid the FTI issue, so we're looking at whether there are other ways that we can do it, given that we're now close to a year behind the timeline that we had anticipated for implementing that functionality.
Well, I think that the legislature agreed and the governor agreed to do that, and that was our directive, and there's potentially large amounts of money on the table from the governor, from the government making mistakes. So I think that it would reflect the legislature's intent to go after that money and find that, and particularly when there's that much at stake. So feedback, take with it what you will. Members are, you can take our binders with you. So we are done with the large binders back for the, taking back to your office for the budget as it comes to the floor. Next meeting, we will be here for Valentine's Day.
Yes.
And look forward to seeing everyone. Have a nice weekend.